You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 11th, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Dust, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, on the Better Biden Doctrine. Then, Sarah Miller, executive director and founder of the American Economic Liberties Project, on corporate America's worst nightmare, Lina Khan, and what they're doing at the Federal Trade Commission. Meanwhile, finally, a massive disruption to air flights that Pete Buttigieg didn't have the ability to prevent. U.S. on track for a brush with the debt ceiling at the end of January. Expect that to be punted multiple times, though. House approves Republican so-called weaponization of government panel. Alabama Attorney General says he'll prosecute women who take abortion pills. Pritzker signs Illinois' ban of assault weapons. Moderna plans a 4,000% markup on COVID vaccines. You know, the ones we paid for to develop. European researchers' new report, past 8 years, hottest on record for the planet. U.S. to train Ukrainians on Patriot missile defense starting next week in Oklahoma. And the Trump finance chief gets 5 months in prison. Meanwhile, Baked Alaska gets 60 days following his January 6th conviction. In Virginia, Democrats flip a state Senate seat that may just save abortion rights in that state. And lastly, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission considering a ban on gas stoves in the wake of increasing reports and studies showing they contribute significantly to child asthma and neurological problems.
More health externalities from fossil fuels, huh?
Surprising. All this and more, as well as the completely unexpected return of Emma Vigeland.
I just thought I'd drop in.
All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Big day here. Emma Vigeland, who we had already rented out her locker. We had
the rental price on that here in downtown Brooklyn.
It's not that high.
Yeah.
Whoa! Look at Bradley.
There we go. Early sound drop. Hello.
Emma Vigeland.
It is hump day.
It is hump day too. Just in time to reclaim your trademark slogan. Yeah. Emma Vigeland, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Do I look tan?
You do.
Okay, good, because if you'd said no, it would have been a slur. You know, I'm from New Jersey, right? You've got to compliment my tan. That's the thing.
I had no idea about that. I'm still not even clear on it,
okay, well,
to be honest with you.
You got to watch Jersey Shore.
I will not be doing that. But welcome back. you didn't miss too much.
Okay.
Republicans finally settled on a Speaker of the House. And we're just waiting for the crap show to ramp up. And on day, I don't know, I guess three of having a new House leader, or day one, really, of the Congress in session, the Republicans passed a bill to cut funding to the IRS. Now, we know something like every dollar that the IRS is given in terms of budget has a somewhere between a $5 and $8 return, because their job is to get revenue from the country. It's the Internal Revenue Service. And the revenue comes back in the form of catching people who have not paid their taxes. And they do this by auditing people. And we also know that when their budget was cut significantly 10 years ago, they increased the rate in which they audited lower income people because they didn't have the resources to go after the millionaires. Now, they still audit millionaires at a higher incidence than lower income people, but that shifted the disparity in which it was 10 years ago, shifted so that there was still more millionaires, but the ratio was not as dramatically different.
My understanding is that's because like the not millionaires get audited through like more algorithmic style automated processes.
Exactly. It's cheaper to audit them, and then you're in more of the volume business than you are in the margin business in terms of driving revenue. When you get a little more resources, you can start going after the bigger fish and win and get more money. Here is Jake Tapper interviewing Representative Mike Johnson about that legislation. And Jake Tapper seems to be like the one holdout on CNN who is not going along with fully with the program of having to pretend that the Republicans are serious about anything.
You supported the House bill, which we just discussed. It would rescind billions of dollars in funding for the IRS. Before the vote, you tweeted, tonight, House GOP will fulfill our promise and vote to block the Biden administration from unleashing 87,000 new IRS agents to go after families and small businesses. That's not accurate. It's 87,000 IRS employees, not IRS agents. It would be over the course of, I think, of a decade, some of them replacing individuals who lose their jobs through attrition. And the Congressional Budget Office says that your bill to get rid of those IRS employees is going to add to the deficit.
Only in the bizarro world of Washington would you get a CBO estimate that says not spending $80 billion is actually going to add to the deficit. It makes
pause it for one second. Yeah. Pause it for one second. Only in that bizarro world and in every single business that operates in any context or any institution.
Spend money, make money. What world are we living in?
Yeah, that's crazy. Who's ever heard of such a thing? I mean, let's just go back to, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago on this program, and we can still have the used computers that we had from 2006 and see if we could stream any of this. This is just like, it is unbelievable that those words could come out of the mouth of a grown-up. But there it is. Just go back a little bit and continue.
Those IRS employees is going to add to the deficit.
Only in the bizarro world of Washington would you get a CBO estimate that says not spending $80 billion is actually going to add to the deficit. It makes no sense.
Because of enforcement for people who are avoiding paying their taxes. As you know, about 10 years ago, if you made more than $10 million a year, one out of five people like that would be audited. Now it's down to like 3.5, 3.6%. The really wealthy people are getting away with not paying their taxes, corporations too.
The intent of hiring all these new agents would have the effect of going after hardworking families and small businesses. That is not a Republican talking point. That comes from the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is a nonpartisan group. They've evaluated this, and they know that it will be the low-hanging fruit that the IRS will go after first, and that's the small business owners and those who are struggling to be entrepreneurs and job creators. And they're the risk takers in our economy who provide jobs for more people. They are not the ones that need scrutiny. What we want, Jake, the Republican Party wants, is an IRS that works for hardworking families, not against them. And that's what this was going to be about, and that's why we fulfilled our commitment to repeal that funding on the very first day. I'm glad we did, and I think if you poll this across the country, I think most of America agrees with us.
Well, it depends on what you're presenting in the poll. Are you saying 87,000 agents are coming at you, booga booga, or is it this funding for IRS enforcement, 87,000 people over the course of a decade, they would be focused on going after individuals who don't pay their taxes, mainly wealthy people and corporations? I think you'd probably get two different answers.
Well, maybe, but when the Joint Committee on Taxation publishes something and presents it, it's given a lot of weight because, again, they're nonpartisan. This is not Republican talking points. This is what the evaluation and the analysis of the White House's proposal and the legislation last year, what it would actually accomplish. And so we disagree with that. We have a different agenda, and I think it's the agenda of the American people.
But I quoted the CBO, and you went after them. They're nonpartisan,
Listen,
too.
Listen, the CBO doesn't have a lot of credibility here right now. Their analysis is wildly inaccurate in a lot of ways, and they don't always do appropriate analysis. And I think
there's going
to be some reforms in that arena as well as we go forward. We have to have dynamic scoring. We have to look at reality when we give estimates on what.
Pause it. First off, there's nothing more dynamic in terms of dynamic scoring than if you spend a certain amount of money and hire people who are going to go after more revenue, then you're going to get more revenue. That's dynamic scoring.
Yeah, he also says that they are not the ones that need enforcement, these small business owners. That's exactly the point. I mean, the small business owner is a myth, but he's claiming, and Tapper's doing a good job there of undercutting it, that this is going after the mom and pop shop or the little Joe down the street. No, this is designed to go after the millionaires.
Let's be clear. Also, you know, mom and pop and little Joe down the street or whoever it is, they're supposed to pay their taxes too.
Yeah. Right.
Everybody's supposed to pay their taxes, but they're going to go where the biggest pot of money is, and that's with millionaires. And we know that when you cut the funding, the number of millionaires who get audited goes down. Keep going.
Have dynamic scoring. We have to look at reality when we give estimates on what legislation is going to cost. And the CBO doesn't do that all the time. I mean, when they come out with an estimate on Capitol Hill right now, there's lots of eye rolling, typically. And that's a problem. And that's part of the problem we have with transparency and doing the American people's business in the way it should be done. America's and we purpose. Are working every day. We're going to continue to work to reform these processes to make Washington work for the people again. Look, this is common sense ideas that will yield transparency and accountability, and I think everybody's for that.
I'm just saying, like, why not just be honest about what the bill would actually do?
I am honest.
You said 87,000 IRS agents. That's not what it is.
Jake, that is exactly what it is. That is the Treasury's own published report in 2021 that they said, as you noted, over a 10-year period, they wanted to add 86,800 and something
employees, agents. And not agents, employees.
Oh, Jake, you know what all those positions are going to be? Have you seen that analysis?
Yeah, he just wants to paint some sort of picture of like the IRS agent coming down your
the
door.
The jackbooted thug. 87,000 Jason Bournes for taxes.
to assassinate you.
Coming in your small business, breaking open the back door, going
Freeze!
Through the till.
And the family never saw him again.
Emma's Bookie says, curious what you guys think of the new requirement of people have to report Venmo Zelle transactions over $600. That's been put off as far as I know. I'm obviously not for defunding the IRS, but that provision does seem like it'd be used to go after normal taxpayers versus normal tax evaders. Well, I don't know what it means to me, go after normal taxpayers. First off, it has always been the case that it is your responsibility. If you pay someone for a business service, $600, and you're a business, you've got to mark that and note that as a 1099. That's just the bottom line. It's always been the case, regardless of whether you do it through Venmo or Zelle or whatever.
Yeah, they're just updating it to incorporate the new technology.
But if this is like you're sending money to your friend or your kid, you don't toggle that thing on whatever it is or Venmo and say it's not for business, and then you're fine. I mean, look, it's a hassle. My daughter, I'm quite convinced, is going to be over $600 in selling her Depop stuff. I have to deal with that. It's pain, without a doubt. And I think maybe there's an argument like, you know, bump it up to $1,000 because I can tell you the profits are not extreme on that. But maybe I even get a deduction at the end of
there
that
like,
depreciation. But the point is that like that is it's being made as if it was nefarious. And it has always been the case that you're supposed to report that. And I think a big part of their doing is like probably to avoid money laundering or something to that.
Well, I mean, you're just trying to clamp down on small business owners like Milo.
Exactly. Believe me. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Matt Duss, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the former, I think, senior foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders. But first, a message from one of our sponsors. One of those sponsors today, Hold On Bags. It's new year, new goals. You made resolutions, new habits. And here is a secret. You don't have to make a big life change to make a big impact, especially when it comes for caring for the earth. All it takes, a better way to go about your daily chores, and you can start with a better bag. Hold On trash and kitchen bags are heavy duty. They are plant-based, non-toxic, 100% home compostable, which means that they break down in weeks and not decades without filling up our landfills or, super important, polluting our oceans. They have zip seal kitchen bags that come in sandwich or gallon size bags to fit all your needs from holding carrots or, I don't know, potato chips. And then I stick crayons in there and pens for my kids. Mm. For me, I'm not going to lie, the biggest use of bags now that I have. I mean, I use them for the kitchen bags, but on a multiple times a day, this is where I really see it, is the cat poop. I've got two cats. I don't want them there, but they're there. And the amount of poop, and frankly, I don't want to get too graphic, but diabetic cats pee like you can't believe. And the number of bags I go through in the course of a day, I don't know, like 3 or 4 bags. And the idea that these things are going to break down in a matter of like in a week's, at least, you know, it probably totally gone within a year or whatnot. The point is they're not going to fill up the landfills. They get into the ocean, they're going to fall apart immediately. And it's just much safer for the planet and safer for animals in the ocean. What?
Yeah, well.
Are they animals?
Yeah, fish.
Mammals?
Yes. Mammals.
Mammals,
yep, fish. There's fish animals. And mammals.
All right.
Fish are animals.
Anyways, the point is Hold On wants to be part of the growing movement away from single-use plastic. And which is, of course, the worst kind of plastic. At every stage of production, disposal, decomposition, those fossil fuel bags are doing harm to our earth, our water, and even our bodies. That's where you get some of those like forever chemicals that we've all find in ourselves now these days. Hold On bags are made from non-toxic ingredients. They are made from plant-based renewables. Hold On trash and kitchen bags meet the highest standards of compostability. They break down in weeks, not in centuries. I mentioned this stat multiple times. 40% of the bags of the plastic that exists on our planet now has been produced in the past 18 years. Oof. We're in trouble when it comes to plastics, folks.
Records all over the place.
This is not a panacea, but I mean, if everybody was using these bags, we'd be in a lot better shape. Shop plant-based bags and replace single-use plastics all over your home. Visit holdonbags.com/majority or enter majority at checkout. Save 20% off your order. Sustainability has never been more simple. That's HOLDON, holdonbags.com/majority or enter majority. Receive 20% off your order. Small things can lead to lasting change. If we stop and we say, hold on, there it is. How's that?
Beautiful.
Folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Matt Duss will join us. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Welcoming back to the program, Matt Duss. He's now visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former senior policy advisor, foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders. Welcome back, Matt.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be here. Hi, Emma.
Hey, Matt.
So, all right, Matt, you and Stephen Wertheim over at the Quincy Institute have written a piece in the New Republic, A Better Biden Doctrine. It is basically a look at an assessment of what Biden's been doing in terms of his foreign policy, set against some of the pledges he made as a candidate, particularly in the general election. And made a little bit of an assessment. I'm going to hold off on trying to give him a grade. Although that's like, let's go through the things that you perceive are positives in the sort of the positive column, and then we'll get into the things where the Biden doctrine could get better.
Sure. Yeah. Well, as you said, I mean, Stephen and I, you know, didn't like. The goal here wasn't to kind of say, here's our ideal foreign policy and here's what Biden's doing and here's how he's falling short. We're trying to kind of look at the commitments that candidate Biden made and the Biden team made on the campaign trail, particularly in the party platform in 2020, and see how, you know, the last 2 years have stacked up compared to those commitments and those goals that they themselves laid out.
And before you get into that, will you just assess relative to what, from your perspective, might be a good foreign policy? Like, where was the Biden sort of, I guess, aspirational doctrine, mm-hmm. let's call it that for a moment. Sure. Where was that relative to where we have been in the preceding, you know, Democratic administrations and maybe Republican ones?
Sure. No, I think, you know, even though Biden himself, as everyone knows, is a longtime, member of Congress, member of the Senate, kind of a creature of the establishment in a lot of ways. I think the platform and, you know, the way that Biden and his team ended up talking about foreign policy was, a considerable improvement. I would say even from the Obama administration. Not just, you know, with things like ending the forever wars, which, again, is something that Senator Sanders and others like Senator Warren in the 2020 primary were talking about. Also, as we note in the piece, like, you know, Biden's speech, for example, that he gave, the first big speech he gave to Congress in April 2021, I think, where he the first where he essentially announced. Where he essentially announced the end of the neoliberal era. I think that's a huge step forward for the president of the United States to basically come before Congress and say, listen, the economic model that we've been using for the past decades has not delivered the American people. The American government is now going to be spending money and investing in American communities now in a big way. And I think that's important. And that obviously has global implications because the kind of global, you know, the neoliberal model of globalization, as we've seen, has contributed to enormous inequality, both here in the United States and around the world. It has contributed to the rise of authoritarianism. We can talk more about that. And this, you know, the kind of democracy versus authoritarianism framing has its real issues and concerns. But I do think as a general understanding of, you know, what should America be trying to do in the world and how should we be trying to do it and what tools should we be using? I think you saw, you know, a lot more creative thinking and frankly, a lot more openness to voices from the left on the, in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and beyond, at least in the fashioning of the platform.
Well, I'm sorry, yeah. Just one more thing. You cited Jake Sullivan saying that domestic foreign policy is domestic policy and domestic policy is foreign policy. What are the implications of that statement? Because it does feel like in the past, there has been a specific attempt to delineate those two things so that the implications of foreign policy and the motivations behind our foreign policy are obscured on within the context of domestic politics.
Right. I mean, I think what that shows, I mean, this is one of those things that people in Washington would say all the time, you know, including, I think, you know, John Kerry, when he ran for president, we need to be strong at home to be strong abroad. You know, it's one of those kind of talking points that you hear. But I think you see a real attempt to actually think through what does that mean? You know, why do we need to, you know, why It's a way of thinking about foreign policy that says every decision we make, every policy we undertake around the world, there needs to be some way to justify this to the American people, to say, this is how this makes your life better. This is how this benefits your community. This is how this promotes our security and prosperity. Because I think, you know, what we saw, I mean, 2016 was a wake-up call for a lot of people for a whole bunch of reasons. Donald Trump's victory, but not just Trump's victory, but I also think the phenomenon of you know, Bernie Sanders' critique of the establishment resonating so widely. I think, you know, for those who were willing to listen, and I do think there are people on Biden's team who were listening, and that includes Jake Sullivan, the lesson, you know, who, of course, was a close advisor to Hillary Clinton. The lesson was, the way we talk about policy in Washington, particularly foreign policy, is completely detached from the lives and realities of so many Americans. And they are deeply skeptical that people in Washington care at all. And that's one of the things that contributed to the kind of populist upsurge, for good and ill. I, obviously, as someone who's close to Bernie Sanders, I think there are huge positives to progressive populism. I have obviously very real concerns with right-wing authoritarian populism. I would make that distinction. But the basic point here is that there needs to be a serious rethink about how we talk about and implement foreign policy. And we have to be very, very mindful of how we justify this to the American people.
Yeah, I think that more holistic view of foreign policy is reflected in this kind of like underreported positive from the Biden administration of how drastically they've reduced drone warfare mm-hmm. in the Middle East. Like, I mean, that was a hallmark of Obama's foreign policy. And then Trump increased them as well. And Biden has drawn them back quietly. And it's that's something I wish got more attention, because I think that is... That fits nicely into your commentary about the way they view foreign policy.
Right. No, I think that's a great point. And we note this in the article. That is a positive. I think, you know, the broader ending the forever wars framework, that is a kind of item that is included in the platform that Biden talked about. That's how he justified, you know, one of the ways in which he justified the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which, as wrenching as it was, I think was the right decision. Even more so over a year later, but at the same time, one of the concerns we raise in the piece is that even though I think Biden is moving in the right direction with regard to drone wars, they've determined, I think with some good reason, that, you know, if we don't make a big deal about these things, I mean, you say it deserves more attention. I think it does deserve more attention. But that's kind of the problem here, is that their approach seems to be, if we don't give like right wing demagogues a target to shoot at, if we do these things quietly and improve policy so that we're killing fewer people with flying robots, but we don't see it all over the New York Times, then we won't have to spend a lot of time responding to, you know, Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and whomever. But the downside of that is, you know, you're leaving those tools in place for a future administration. And you're also not, by not engaging in a very public and energetic debate around what the right policy should be, you're kind of leaving, you're leaving a consensus in place. And I think, you know, the bottom line in my view is, if you want to change and create a better consensus around these tools and policies, you need to get into public debates and win them.
I thought that was a fascinating point you made in your piece, and I hadn't really contemplated that. The analogy I see is, I remember in 2010 when the Obama administration on the domestic front was like, we don't want to expend any political capital explaining why, government tightening its belt is not the same as, like, you know, the belt tightening for, you know, around the kitchen table. And unfortunately, they not only wanted to expend the capital to engage in that fight, they capitulated in that fight. Mm. In this instance, the Biden administration does not want to engage in that fight, but they're winning that fight, but it is a Pyrrhic victory if the American public is not made to understand why the use of drones is problematic, broadly speaking. Right. And that's the point you're making. And I thought that was fascinating. Let's move on to some of the other areas where the Biden administration is not meeting their own standards that they set. One of them, they've cut back dramatically on the drone war. they said they were going to shift their position in terms of support for the Saudis relative to Yemen, but that really hasn't been the case.
Well, I think they have, you know, significantly diminished support. You know, they came out early on and announced that they would be ending, you know, quote, offensive support for the Saudi war in Yemen, but they would continue defensive support, you know, for Saudis defending its own territory. And again, you know, having, you know, being on the Hill at the time, you know, I and other colleagues and other offices made efforts for months to get them to try and kind of, you know, actually explain what this distinction meant. And it was very difficult. And they, you know, my point being, like, if the president and his team are saying, are making this distinction publicly, they should be able to explain what it means publicly. And we never were, never got an explanation that was really satisfying. But, you know, the basic point is, yes, they significantly diminished the amount of support they were giving to the Saudis. Did they fully end support? You know, do they continue to supply and repair and contribute to the upkeep of Saudi planes that that do these bombings, even those bombings have significantly diminished? Yes, they do. And they've also invested, and I think this deserves good credit, and we give it to them in the piece, you know, by creating a special envoy, Tim Lenderking, with whose job was to try and find a diplomatic resolution to this devastating war. I mean, they really sort of, you know, they put their policy, you know, money where their mouth was, so to speak. They really invested policy energy in that effort. They achieved a ceasefire and then an extension of the ceasefire. So is the crisis ongoing? It still is. Is the war ongoing? It is. The situation has improved somewhat. You know, there are talks that Lenderking has been engaged with among the sides. He's been coordinating very closely with the UN. That's all positive. But still, the broader issue of the U.S.-Saudi relationship, without question, I think, has been a disappointment. You know, Biden said, I want to make him a pariah in reference to Mohammed bin Salman. You know, they did this thing where they released the kind of intelligence report around the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But since then, it's been a slow but steady kind of revert to the norm, which is a very close relationship with the United States and Saudi Arabia.
That was in large, it seemed to me, in large part, a function of them fighting the inflation narrative and a combination of the inflation we saw in the context of oil prices, which was, I mean, to a large extent, about refining capacity, at least, it seems to me, that had been drawn down during COVID. And then there was a refusal to ramp it back up, because why do you ramp these things back up when you know maybe down the road you're going to be having a diminished need for fossil fuel refining capacity, because that's the way the world is going. So let's and the for the past year, the war, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. Yep. Let's talk about that and your perspective on the Biden administration's approach to that. And then we'll get to China, which I think is far more problematic in many respects.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the segue makes sense, right? Because even, I mean, the justification you'll hear from a lot of the folks in the administration is like, well, Ukraine changed everything. You know, you know, we can't be fighting with the Saudis at the same time we're trying to help the Ukrainians fight the Russians. But the fact is, I mean, this kind of rapprochement between the U.S. and Mohammed bin Salman was well underway before, you know, the Ukraine war happened. I mean, it's just, it provides, I think, I don't totally discount it. I think it is true. It has made things much more complicated. But I think it also in some ways provided a very convenient excuse to do and accelerate what they were going to do. Anyway, because, you know, it's not just oil. This is a very, this is a deeply rooted relationship, for good or ill. I would say mostly ill, not just on the issue of energy, but on, you know, intelligence, on defense. Obviously, Saudi Arabia spends a lot of money on American weapons and put lots of money in the bank accounts of defense contractors. And they would like very much for that money to continue to go to their bank accounts. So, you know, shifting this relationship is an enormous challenge in the best case scenario, which we are not in right now, because, as you said, Ukraine. So, yeah, I think we in general, you know, think all things considered, Biden has handled Ukraine fairly well. You know, I think their goal, they've articulated like three main goals here. One is not to be drawn into a war with Russia, the United States, or NATO. It's to help Ukraine defend its own, its territorial integrity, and to produce a strategic defeat for Russia. Now, I think the, you know, all of those things, I think thus far are they're succeeding at. You know, I think in my view, it's interesting, you know, a lot of my colleagues and friends at what might be called the restraint camp, including you mentioned Quincy Institute, you know, folks who I know and have worked with for a long time. You know, I think some of these folks on both the left and right have been a bit more critical of Biden on Ukraine, raising some questions, which I think are legitimate questions of what are our interests in Ukraine. But my own view is, you know, Biden is practicing restraint in Ukraine. He's being very cautious not to be drawn in, not to allow the U.S. to be drawn in, certainly with U.S. troops, which he took off the table very early on. But at the same time, he does recognize, I think rightly, that there is a pretty foundational international norm at stake here with regard to, you know, states should not, you know, be allowed to invade and steal large chunks of land from their smaller, weaker neighbors.
I don't want to make it seem like I read every quote that you have in every piece, Matt, but I know just a couple of days ago you had said something to the effect of like, you know, there it is important to make sure that this our helping with the protection of Ukrainian sovereignty, I'm paraphrasing you now, needs, you know, we need to be careful that it doesn't slide too much into the protection of those bank accounts.
Yeah.
How do we do that? Like, where is the line? I mean, this has been my perspective from the beginning. It's like, you know, what's the end game here? And how do we know when we've achieved it? And I would use the same analogy in terms of like, we're not, the administration has decided not to invest in its political cash in the fight about why drone wars are bad.
Mm-hmm.
The analogy here, like, how do we not increase the role of militarization if we're fighting? I mean, it is like largely, like you say, we have a strategic, there's a strategic benefit for us to have Russia's capacity to wage an invasion like this diminished significantly. You know, some people might refer to that as a proxy war. I mean, arguably it is. But what's the limiting principle here?
Yeah. No, I think the limiting principle is, you know, a sovereign state, democratic or not. I mean, this is why I even though I think it is good to support democracies and not support autocracies, I think, I think the issue here is, you know, Ukraine's sovereign territory has been invaded and Ukraine has a right to defend it. Now, that's certainly something the United States has violated in the past. It's something we've supported our partners and client states in violating in the past. And I think that's a very fair point to raise. And we should discuss it when appropriate. But that, I think my approach here would be say, well, let's do better ourselves. We do have an interest. And again, as a progressive, I think we do have an interest in, you know, supporting and forging a set of norms and strengthening those norms and pushing others to follow those norms and rules, so that might does not simply make right. But I think the question of where does this end, where is this going, that's a powerful one. I think the approach right now has been to continue to support Ukraine. And I think we were in a very different situation, say, in the early summer when things seemed to be stalemated. We saw a very effective kind of series of campaigns by the Ukrainian military in late summer and the fall to take back large swaths of territory. I think the approach right now is to continue to support that and put the Ukrainians in the best possible position for negotiation when those negotiations become ripe, become possible. And I would note here that, you know, it is Vladimir Putin who has not really shown any interest in those negotiations. I mean, I would very much agree with those who say that the administration should be maintaining contact and trying to reach out to the Russians at all levels. And I think they are doing that. I mean, we saw a flurry of stories in the fall around, you know, national security advisor Jake Sullivan's contact with people who are very close to Putin. We see the ongoing, you know, so-called red phone between Secretary of Defense Austin and Russian Defense Minister Shoigu. We've seen, you know, meetings at various levels in various places all along. I think this is the way that you kind of continue to put feelers out to identify possible paths to eventual negotiations. I do think there's a sense out there. I think it's all, you know, often offered in good faith, sometimes not. But the idea that we should just be doing more diplomacy, if we just press the diplomacy button harder, then we could end this war sooner. And I sympathize with that. But I do think from what I've seen and read, you know, the administration is doing the work to try to identify a credible path to a negotiated end.
Let's turn to China, where it feels like we've headed in the wrong direction. And there's some tension here. I mean, aside from the fact that, like, as early as, in 2012, I can't remember what ship I was on. I was stuck in Long Beach overnight because they gave me a voucher. You know, if I took a later flight from LA, that's the truth. And I wanted that cash. But I was on, like, and it was like a warship on Long Beach. Maybe it was an aircraft carrier. And I went into this, like, room, and there's a guy there, and there's a whole map of the U.S. Fleet. This is like 10, 15 years ago, and they just like moved everything over to the Pacific for the Asian pivot. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, the TPP that Obama was pushing was all part of this Asian pivot. And we see this increasing sort of like, I'm quite convinced that Iraq, frankly, was about China as well. I've told this story many times about Gary Hart's 21st century threat to U.S. Security held and that wrapped up, and told the Bush administration that it was non-state terrorist that they should watch out for. And there was one person on this committee who every time they met kept bringing up China. When they finally laughed her out of the room, she never came back. But that was Liz Cheney or Lynn Cheney, I should say.
Lynn Cheney.
And so, but
well, if you remember, I mean, not to just stay in this room. I mean, China was the new hotness right before 9/11. I mean, folks remember this. Remember the Hainan Island incident very early in the Bush administration. You know, you had an American plane that was essentially forced down by Chinese fighters. You know, through the 90s, I mean, China was going to be the new big enemy. I mean, this city was getting ready for that. And all of a sudden, you know, it turns out, no, actually, we're going to slot in terrorism for the Soviets instead of slotting in China. But now we've kind of returned to plan A.
And you know, there's some, like, you know, the COVID showed the need to sort of like make our supply lines a little bit more, a little bit closer and a little bit more durable. But there's a way of doing that where we do not decouple ourselves from China, because having that reliance on China also inhibits the potential for some type of conflict, because we're in the same boat. They need us, we need them. The way that we make our supply lines more robust is as important as making them more robust.
No, that's absolutely right. And this gets to the broader issue here. It's like, you know, we need to diversify and create redundancy and resiliency in supply lines, because that is good for our country. That's going to protect us from a whole range of potential crises. You know, we need to invest in American industry and, you know, in American communities, because that's what the American government should do for American communities. We don't need to justify all this, or we shouldn't need to justify all this on the basis of this is how we fight China. And yet, unfortunately, this tends to be, you know, a way of pressing the easy button in politics, is to justify it all in terms of this is how we defeat the big new enemy. And I understand that impulse, but I think, you know, and as Stephen and as I write in the piece, yes, there are certainly very legitimate challenges and concerns with the Chinese government and their policies and their vision for China's role, you know, versus the United States in the world. We should be clear-eyed about that. But the administration does seem to be moving in a direction of, you know, basic of, you know, any economic success, or I'll put it this way, that crushing China economically and suppressing China's economic growth is part of how we win. And here, this is an area where I think President Biden's rhetoric and his policy are telling two different stories, as we put it in the piece. I mean, President Biden, and we appreciate this, you know, whenever he speaks with President Xi, or, you know, he speaks about U.S.-China policy, it's we don't seek a Cold War, we're not seeking conflict, we need to identify areas of cooperation. And that is good, because that is all absolutely true. But when you see things like a few months ago, the announcement of restrictions on semiconductors, these are very severe measures. You know, because ultimately, as I said, we're going to be clear-eyed about, you know, China's policies and its goals, and, you know, compete with them where we can and must. But ultimately, we need to find some way of coexisting. And I think the policy is sort of locking us into a very competition, if not conflict, frame here.
Let me ask you just one more question about a region that you didn't really address in, and this is, I guess, more a sort of a broader one. When you know, we just watched what took place in Brazil, and where are we in terms of this hemisphere and our disposition towards, you know, left of center governments in this hemisphere, because, you know, traditionally we haven't had a great record with that.
That is true.
You may be aware of that.
I am somewhat aware. I've heard tell of such things. No, I think, listen, the quick recognition of Lula's victory by the White House, followed within 24 hours by a phone call between President Biden and Lula, is enormously positive. And it's a very positive change from the Obama administration, who kept Lula at arm's length. So, I mean, this is an area where I think there has been really positive change. And part of it is that, you know, this is Biden responding to a different political environment. And I'll just give credit here to Senator Sanders, who has been, you know, very vocal about this, particularly, you know, about Brazil's elections, because Bolsonaro very clearly modeled himself on Trump and was very clearly teeing up a stop the steal movement for the election. Senator Sanders, along with Senator Kaine, offered a resolution out of the Senate making clear that the U.S.-Brazil relationship would suffer, including the military relationship would suffer in the if there were any shenanigans. That resolution passed by unanimous consent. But that kind of, you know, affirmed and was meant to underline and reinforce, I think, some of the messages that the administration was already sending, including by dispatching CIA Chief Bill Burns, Secretary of Defense Austin, and Jake Sullivan himself down at various times for consultations with their counterparts in Brazil to send that message that we want a free and fair election. And I think that was very well done. So that's an area, and you're right, we didn't mention it, but that's something I think they do deserve credit for, their posture toward Lula, but also towards some of these other more left populist governments we've seen, like Petro, like Boric and others in the region, is very, very different from what we've seen from past democratic administrations.
At the same time, they're hosting democracy summits and saying that Guaido is the legitimate leader, right? So those are improvements. Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. I just think, you know, back to your critique that was, you know, more big picture about their inability to sell some of this stuff to the American people.
Yeah.
It seems like outside of a few key areas, they are in a defensive posture. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in terms of, you know, military operations abroad, but, you know, I hear your recommendations. There's a lot of action words, like they should be proactive on this or they should be forging this.
Yeah.
And for most of the through line that I see is that when Democrats come in, sometimes there's restoration. There's an effort of stabilization because Trump wrecked so many things, but less of an active push towards restoration. And then things continue to devolve. Like what we're seeing with our relationship with Iran is that that peace deal is shattered.
Yeah.
It seems to be the case. So do you agree with that general critique?
I would agree. And I think, you know, the one overall approach this administration takes to foreign policy in general is we want to spend as little time as necessary fighting about foreign policy. You know, and I get, you know, and in very practical terms, I guess that makes sense. They want to be talking about things that the administration is doing and delivering for the American people that are much more tangible in a way that kind of a lot of these sort of high flown foreign policy debates aren't, or they feel they aren't. But the problem is, as I said, with regard to drone strikes and the war on terror, is the downside is that you are not, you know, forging a new and durable consensus about America's role in the world. And, you know, I would go even farther. You know, it's not even a restoration on a lot of these things from, you know, Obama. It is an affirmation of Trump's approach on some of these things, like Iran. Essentially, you know, that we say straightforwardly, Biden broke his promise to quickly rejoin the Iran nuclear agreement. They dragged their feet. They tried to keep pressure on in the hopes that they could potentially maybe get a longer and stronger deal. And what is the result? We may never get that deal back. We've just continued with all the sanctions that Trump put on. And we're now in a situation where we're you know, very much in a worse position on Iran's nuclear program than we were, you know, even under Trump. And again, with, you know, with China, it's a very similar thing. The president's rhetoric is better. But if you look at the actual policy and the approach they are taking and the path that's putting us on, it is very similar to Trump.
And I should correct myself, because while I was out, I guess there was the official change on Guaido. But you know, I was harkening back to a little bit earlier. But no, just note that.
And we should say that official change came in large part because his tenure as acting president. I love just the idea of acting president.
You're acting president.
I've been acting.
You've been the acting U.S.
senator. I'm acting host of the show.
I love the idea that one can be acting president, and that term, I guess, his term came to an end. But Matt, I had a lot more questions. We're going to have you back because we didn't even touch on Africa. But I think in a large spot, the perspective, it's sort of a rather ad hoc when it comes to a large swath of that continent. But we will talk more about that next time we have you. Matt Duss, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll put a link to your piece that you wrote with Stephen Wertheim in the New Republic and talk to you again soon. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, folks, got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Sarah Miller. She's the executive director and founder of the American Economic Liberties Project. We're going to be talking about the FTC's new proposed rule on non-compete agreements. And also, I want to hear more about this price discrimination move that the FTC is making. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland. Want to welcome to the program Sarah Miller. She's the executive director and founder of the American Economic Liberties Project. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Lina Khan has been very busy over the past couple of days in particular, but I mean, really, since she's been the chair of the FTC, there's two things I want to talk to you about. One is It is a proposed ban on non-compete agreements. My understanding is there is now the comment period has started. It is about probably, I think we got 58 more days or something like that, maybe 57, where people can comment on this proposed rule. It was voted on 3-1 to get to this stage where they will take the comments from the public. give us some background on this proposed ban.
Great. So non-competes affect roughly 1 in 5 workers in the country. That's around 30 million people. They affect high-income workers like executives. There's a very high prevalence of their use among kind of that cohort of the workforce. But they're, from a numbers perspective, they affect more kind of mid-wage and hourly workers, janitors, security guards, hairstylists, fitness instructors, nurses and doctors and veterinarians and journalists. They are just really a pretty staple feature of employment contracts at this point and have really been popularized over the last 20 or so years. So a number of states have kind of stepped up to try to regulate the use of these non-compete agreements. But what the FTC is proposing is a complete ban on including these agreements in employment contracts. And then they're also kind of going even further and looking at sort of implicit ways that employers tend to try to tie workers to their jobs, like through things like training repayment agreement provisions or TRAPS, which require you to pay your employer training costs if you leave to take a new job. And there's a whole lot of worker harms directly that result from non-compete agreements, and then broader economic harms, which we should dive into.
Let's dive into those. I mean, we know about, talk about wage suppression, but it goes beyond that.
Yeah. The FTC economists found this kind of staggering figure that there's an annual kind of decrease in workers' wages by roughly $300 billion. So that's a 3 to 4% difference than
annually.
An economy in which. Yeah. Yes.
Sorry.
So these are not small numbers that we're talking about here. This is a major kind of systemic, kind of counter pressure on workers' wages in this country, right? And so I think there's an impact both on your paycheck, right? Not only for workers that are subject for non-competes, but from workers that are locked out of competing for positions in a more kind of robust labor market, right? So it doesn't only affect workers who are bound by these, but it affects the labor market as a whole. It affects your ability to go start a new business if you have an idea. These non-competes prevent you from starting a competing firm. So that depresses innovation, it depresses economic dynamism, it depresses job creation because startups and smaller firms are such a crucial part of the job creation machine. And it hurts employers in lots of ways, too. If you're an employer, you want to be able to compete for the workers that are right for you. And this kind of locks people into certain jobs and really gums up the labor market. So, I think good for Lina Khan for seeing that this is a practice that has both implications for individual freedom and well-being, but also has systemic economic implications that are really harmful both for the labor market and for the economy on the whole.
Well, you mentioned like the fact that white collar workers will get non-compete clauses, right? And that's, I think, what most people associate non-competes with. But some of the examples of, I mean, you said 1 in every 5 workers, that's just a staggering figure, right? Some of the examples of people who will be forced to sign non-competes are, say, if you're working at Jimmy John's, right? And they don't want you to go and work at Subway or something like that.
Exactly.
These go all the way down to minimum wage jobs, and that's really where it's most harmful, frankly.
Yeah, I think it's harmful across the board. Certainly, there's an impact in the healthcare sector when you have doctors locked into jobs and you have exploding healthcare costs. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. But you see some of the most marginalized workers, like Jimmy John's employees, and Jimmy John's use of non-competes and the lawsuit that I think the New York AG brought back in 2014 sort of put this on the map in the first place as a really pervasive and abused part of the employment kind of landscape, it is exactly right. So I think this looks at this practice. It looks at the authority, the FTC looks at the authority that it's been given to prohibit unfair methods of competition. And it seems pretty clear that they have the authority to promulgate this rule.
So they've put it up for comment 60 days. Then they revote after 60 days, and let's presume that the majority of comments are, they don't have to follow the comments. This is not a vote, but not a plebiscite, but this is, you know, a way to get different ideas. And so they can have different perspectives. It's also statutorily mandated that they do this when they're promulgating a regulation. But let's assume that 60 day passes, they have another vote. They pass this. Does it go right into effect? Cause I got all these guys locked up on the show. And I don't want them going around to, like, you know, some other, like, what happens? Do all of a sudden?
Well, I probably shouldn't give you legal advice, Sam.
I understand. All right, we don't have to make it specific to me, but what happens? Is the extensive contracts I have with everybody here, are they basically you know, just void? And the next day they can go somewhere.
Yeah, so there's two ways to think about this. So I think if you want to look at it from kind of a formal legal standpoint, the FTC will put out a final rule at some point after they've reviewed the comments and made any revisions. And then that rule will have 180 days to take effect. So firms will have 180 days to comply. That said, the FTC has actually started enforcing against this already. And last week, they sued three companies. One was a security guard company who had particularly abusive non-competes in their employment contracts. So they're already sending a signal to, you know, to employers that we're really going to focus on this and you might want to get ahead of it. So I think we'll also start to see businesses kind of just proactively say, you know what, it's not worth it. While kind of the largest employers, your Chamber of Commerce's and really big trade associations are going to fight this tooth and nail.
Let's talk about Section 5, because one of the implications of this is that it supposedly going to revive Section 5. What is Section 5? Why has it been dormant? What are the implications of it being revived?
Yeah, so Section 5 of the FTC Act grants the FTC the authority to prohibit unfair methods of competition. Historically, over the last 40 years in particular, the FTC has had a very kind of narrow view of what its role is. And there's been a lot of debate and conversation about that, as I think policymakers and the general public have become more aware of the kind of severe consequences of corporate concentration all across the economy. So this is coming in a broader broader political context that centers kind of the need to attack monopoly power and to approach this from a variety of ways in the kind of political discourse. So, you know, the FTC has pretty wide authority under that statute to define and determine unfair methods of competition. And I think when you look at kind of the systemic harms of non-competes, when you look just practically at the fairness of something like a non-compete, it's kind of all in the name here. It's pretty straightforward. The FTC is on really solid ground, both from a policy and a legal perspective, in pursuing this rulemaking.
We hope, right? I mean, the Supreme Court, and we should say, you know, we've talked about this on this program many, many times in the past. But the shift in the essentially the government and the sort of the institutions surrounding this, both the sort of the antitrust bar and everyone shifted in the Reagan years, you know, basically spearheaded by Robert Bork and the sort of the Chicago University of Chicago perspective on what antitrust was about. It moved from one that dealt with all of the implications of having trusts and monopolies in terms of what it meant for competition, broadly speaking, and political power and fairness. And it just shifted down to this very narrow perspective of what theoretically makes it cheaper for the consumer. And we tried that. It didn't work out very well. And so we're seeing this pushback. But the Supreme Court, they have not gotten this memo. Or to the extent that they have, they've disregarded it. There was a case last year where, or maybe it was in 2021, where they started to inhibit the power of the FTC in terms of getting the way they would find remuneration for these violations. Can you just talk about that? And because this proposed rule, if, in the event that it becomes a rule, which it looks like it will, could very well end up in front of the court, which I think is, relatively speaking, well, I mean, it's the same. It's the same 6-3 court.
Right, right. I think one of the interesting things to note about both the Department of Justice's kind of antitrust litigation strategy and the FTC's is they're very cognizant of the need to expand the boundaries of antitrust law from this very narrow set of interpretation that judges have kind of built into the case law over the years. The DOJ just won a kind of case against two large publishing companies that they argued on behalf of the labor market and the impact that it would have on the labor market. So what we're seeing, I think, is a slow and an inconsistent shift in the judiciary around how they're interpreting and deciding antitrust cases that touch on different kind of areas under the agency's jurisdiction. Obviously, I think the Supreme Court has proven to be fairly hostile to the administrative case, administrative state in many cases. The politics around the non-compete rule in particular, I think, are very interesting. We saw Republicans step up and support this ban. We've seen Republicans work with Democrats on bans that would apply to lower income workers. And in general, the politics around antitrust have been very scrambled and often bipartisan in surprising ways. So there's real kind of debates happening in corners that you wouldn't expect. Last month, Jonathan Cantor, who's the head of antitrust at the DOJ, gave a long talk at the Federalist Society of all places. So while, you know, I kind of hesitate to predict a Supreme Court decision that, you know, might come down the line, I think this presents a really important and galvanizing political fight. And, you know, we're trying to encourage as many people as possible to weigh in and kind of share their stories through the comment process. I think that will be really important.
So let's move to the second big news of, I don't know, the week, or at least of the new year. The FTC is now investigating, or there's a preliminary investigation of Coke and Pepsi relative to something called price discrimination, which it runs afoul of the Robinson-Patman Act, which when I read that, I thought Matt Stoller, who I know also works at the American Economics Liberties Project, was, couldn't have had probably a bigger smile on his face on that day. Everything I know about Patman, I know from reading his book. Explain to us what this is and what the implications of this is and what the implications of reviving the Robinson-Patman Act. I mean, the interesting thing about this is that for years, I mean, going back to 2014, 2015, maybe 20, even earlier, when there was this sort of nascent revival, which I know you were a part of at a different outfit, a nascent revival of antitrust. And I would interview people about it, and everyone was saying, like, we don't need to pass any new laws. It is really just basically all these tools are there. It's just the people have to decide that they're going to use a hammer again as a hammer instead of, like, you know, I don't know, a paperweight or a way to keep a door open. And that seems like it's happening now with this administration. Tell us about this price discrimination investigation and the Robinson-Patman Act.
Yeah, I will. Non-competes are pretty straightforward and simple. Robinson-Patman Act is a little bit more complicated. So towards the middle of last year, the FTC took its first step to start reinvigorating the Robinson-Patman Act, and they looked at pharmacy benefit managers. So they looked at drug prices. The Robinson-Patman Act prohibits not only price discrimination, but also commercial bribery. And so the fee structure between drug manufacturers and pharmacy benefit managers potentially, and this is something the FTC is investigating, is in violation of the Robbins-Patman Act and its prohibition on commercial bribery, right, which they call rebates or fees, right, but essentially result in illegal kickbacks and things of that nature. So that was the first kind of time that the Robbins-Patman Act was kind of revived in pursuit of the FTC's mission, and that was a unanimous, I think it, that was unanimously approved, actually, which was quite remarkable for a law that's been dormant for the better part of 40 years. The reporting yesterday, which I don't think has been confirmed by the FTC, but certainly has been a main focus of one of the FTC's Democratic commissioners, Alvaro Bedoya, would look at price discrimination in the beverage market, so Coke and Pepsi. Part of the reason why Robbins-Patman was not enforced is because there was a belief that large kind of chain stores like your Walmarts were more efficient, and it was kind of a values choice, right? We want to kind of centralize commerce. That was essentially what's happened. You see Walmart, you see Target, you see Amazon, like these big centralized retailers. And that lower, smaller stores are not efficient, right? And so the way that the larger chain stores help us kind of centralize their power or exercise their market power is by extracting lower prices from wholesalers that smaller firms can't get because they lack the bargaining power. So for Robbins-Patman essentially made that illegal and said, if you're a wholesaler, you have to sell your carton of orange juice to Walmart at the same price that you sell your carton of orange juice to Bob's Groceries down the street. And so because of that, the failure of that enforcement, I think the downstream effects are things like food deserts, are things like higher prices, maybe ironically, or what, you know, certain people might argue with that. But across the board, you see, you know, more market power among your Walmarts and, you know, smaller retailers kind of forced to price very high to compensate for the price that they get. So, you know, I think this is an area that's really, really important and that has downstream effects on everyday people, whether it's because you don't have a grocery store in your neighborhood anymore or because you're paying, which obviously millions of Americans are, unconscionably high prices for insulin that the Robbins-Patman Act has a direct bearing on.
It must also impact wages again, too, in terms of like disempowering workers, because if, you know, I am making it cheaper for Walmart to sell my orange juice, that is going to eliminate the competition down the road from Bob's supermarket. And if Bob and Walmart aren't, you know, trying to vie for the same employees, Walmart has a monopsony there and has the ability to drive down wages in that community.
Absolutely. I think the knock-on effects of the level of market power that, in the case of your Walmarts and your retailers, was allowed to accumulate is quite broad. And it's something I think we're still trying to fully understand.
Let me ask you this, too. And I know they haven't confirmed that they're doing it, but is this a backdoor way into which to deal with Amazon? Because it seems to me that nobody has, I mean, there's a multitude of other things that I think are problematic about Amazon. But one of those areas is both price discrimination and I would imagine also even just sort of like, I don't know what the word for it is, supply discrimination. I just remember during the, you know, I've mentioned this story a couple of times, but during in the wake of the pandemic, local bike store was like, I can't get a hold of these type of tires. And, yeah. But I go on Amazon and they're there. My wholesaler can't get them. And then I just put in there, like, can I order 60 of these from Amazon? And they seem to have cornered the market. Because they use their buying power to do that. I you know, we're not going to take your 10 or 15 or 20 of these rare tires. And if we don't, you're going to be stuck with them. We're going to take all 60 of them. So no one else can sell them.
Absolutely. I mean, anecdotally, we heard about this happening in a number of different industries where smaller retailers and smaller companies couldn't access supply and contracts essentially weren't honored because larger firms were able to secure that supply, even if, you know, there were contracts on the books with other firms. So that is a different kind of manifestation of the, you know, buyer power that Robbins-Patman seeks to address and seeks to help constrain. I think one of the examples of how this power has been abused comes from Amazon. It's when they acquired diapers.com by simply underpricing diapers. So they lost money on their diaper business until diapers.com was faced with a choice. We sell to Amazon, we let Amazon acquire us, or we're going to go out of business. And under kind of the Robinson-Patman Act legal regime that's currently in place, that was deemed legal. I think there's a real question as to whether that sort of predatory and abusive behavior that kind of forces a business to either sell or die should continue to go unenforced.
Well, Sarah Miller, Executive Director and Founder of the American Economic Liberties Project, I imagine we're going to be talking to you more over the next couple of years, because I think the most interesting stuff that's going to be happening in this during this the next 2 years is going to be coming out of the FTC and probably the DOJ in terms of antitrust. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. I'm going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. We're a little late. What are you going to do?
Yeah, two good guests. You got to go late.
What are we going to do? We've got to hopefully we'll get some calls from some folks on the IM have said that they're going to call in. They've either visited the nurses' strikes in New York City over the past day or two, or maybe they're going to call in from the the picket lines. That would be great.
Yeah.
The number is 646-257-3920. Just want to remind you, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the fun half, but you also get the free half free of commercials. You help this show survive and thrive, and you get like search. You can IM the show as a member through the app at Majority App. Just a reminder, the Android app is out. Kyle actually did an update last night because there was some one or two little bugs for some one of the 15,000 Android devices that exist out there. So go get it updated. Update it. Again, if you have any bugs with it, do that. Bradley Fan Club says, excellent interviews this year so far. Is your refrigerator running? We have a little construction outside. That's happening all over the place. I had a jackhammer last night at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, my gosh.
Wait, really?
Yeah, there was some water main broken.
Oh, it was an emergency thing. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean,
there's construction right behind my apartment, and every day right at 8 a.m. Mm-hmm. in the morning.
Because they have to wait right until 8 a.m. and but then they start do it up on right the dot. After yeah. That.
Yeah. So don't forget, folks, you can become a member because of that. Jointhemajorityreport.com. The construction thing could be an issue over the next couple of months because they're building a building literally.
Right, like next
12
door.
Feet from us.
Yep.
Like literally
out our window.
12 just, feet from us.
You'll be charmed by it.
Yes.
I'm sure.
It'll make the show that much more charming in some respects. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Emma Vigeland has returned just in time for the playoffs and for the Red Sox to sell off all of their good players and get rid of all their good players.
Yeah,
and
that new ownership group is just cheap.
Well, it's not the ownership group, is it? I mean, is it the general manager?
No, I mean, they're bought by this, by Fenway Sports Group, and
that's not
also,
Henry and other.
No, they've sold. And so it's
what?
Now, they
look for synergies.
When did that happen?
They also bought the Pittsburgh Penguins. So I'll be happy when they, cheap out on players there. But, I mean, I want to do, again, I've been saying this, but I want to do a deep dive into these ownership groups a few years ago.
What?
They've now, that's I why they let Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts walk, because they're not paying their guys.
Gotta tighten our belts around here,
apparently,
around Fenway.
Yeah. I mean, the Red Sox, they should have the same business model as the Tampa Bay Rays, I guess. That makes sense.
It's fun to like have a curse, so it's like what you do actually finally win World Series, and you're like, oh, we're done. We can just be good until another 80 years from now.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I'm all about the Worcester Sox anyway.
So yeah, there you go.
Sox.
Boston Red Sox. Sox.
That's John Henry's group, Fenway Sports Group. Is his? They own the Penguins, the Sox, and the Liverpool.
How's that different from what he had before?
Well, it's just, it's different because they own, it's an ownership group that owns a bunch of different, they also
they've
own
expanded
Liverpool,
like they're,
right?
They're owning,
they've expanded.
Like they're becoming more of like a multi-team.
So they're becoming a, I see.
And so they become profit motivated as opposed to what's happening with the New York Mets where it's like.
They're becoming a holding group as opposed to a.
Yes.
Okay, I got it.
And it's bad for the fans.
Yeah, that shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah. Well, especially with baseball because there's no salary cap. So the lack of spending hurts the Sox more than it will hurt the Pittsburgh Penguins, for example, because there's a cap and also hockey's cheap. Wait, so what were we talking about? Oh, ESPN. we'll be back. Mega episode. And then we're back to our regular schedule. But tomorrow it's going to be a long episode. So we're going to be recapping a very eventful week 18. I did a little update on the Damar Hamlin situation from my vacation, but I want to dive deeper into that. And as well as like, I think the NFL needs to investigate the Houston Texans for firing black head coaches after 1 year back-to-back and tanking seasons when they clearly want to hire an inexperienced former quarterback because he prays with the owner named Josh McCown. I'm going to do a deep dive into that. And, of course, wild card weekend preview. Man, and my Giants are in the playoffs. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I actually think they have a chance in this game on Sunday. So if they actually win and they're in the next, they're playing next weekend, that might conflict with the show that we're doing at the Cutting Room. I'll still be there, but
checking
it might,
her phone on.
But it might be an interesting situation. So, youtube.com/ESPN show. Things are about to get really, really interesting with the playoffs.
Things are about to get really interesting right now too, because I'm going off on two people on the who are just
on the IM.
One, Eddie Munster, just says you don't have to say in the morning if you say 8 or 3 x a.m. I know I don't have to, but I'm trying to reiterate that
it's redundancy. It's fundamental to communication.
That's right. I don't have to say you are very, very pedantic. I could just say you're very pedantic, but I want to say very, very to hit that home. And Tater Tot, I know they just locked up Devers for a decade, but I am old enough to remember Boomer. I am old enough to remember Jim Rice. Like, I know what they do. They put a guy in there who can hit a bunch of home runs, so the games seem exciting, and they keep you interested for the season, and then they can't really deliver at the end. All right? Mm-hmm. So don't give me that.
Yeah.
In 2004, the first year they break the curse, what am I doing in 2004?
What?
It is the run-up to the 2004 election with George Bush. I'm working 6 to 9 or 7 to 10 at night. I can't see a single playoff game.
Jesus.
Watch Bush win his second term.
Exactly. Janine and I are doing the Majority Report on Air America Radio, and I can't watch a goddamn single game. I'm like, please, why not more doubleheaders on a Sunday?
They were doing it specifically to mess with you.
No radio host can watch.
Yeah.
God.
Discrimination, honestly.
Matt!
Yeah. Speaking of Sunday, January 22nd, 2023, this is Revolution Left Reckoning. Give Them Argument. Left is Best live in New York City at the Cutting Room. Get your tickets at TicketWeb. Last night on Left Reckoning, we had Bhaskar Sankara to get reflective on our 100th episode. Brian Muir to talk about Lula and the sort of attempted a Jan 6th in Brazil, and our friend Aaron Brown hang around for the post game. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that.
Going to take a quick break. I think also I'm going to be on Give Them an Argument, I think on the 17th. I don't know what day that is. I think it's Tuesday.
That plus the live show, right?
Plus the live show, yeah. But we'll talk more about that in a bit. All right, quick break. Fun half, 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back, back.
Snowflakes as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. Back.
And the Africans are black
African.
And the alpha males are black.
And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on!
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.